note.
Because we have to keep up. What a week. Weyerhaeuser is moving from the burbs to the city square. Websites we've never heard of are going for $1 billion. Burger King is Canadian.
Life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
Amen. And that's what KUOW's Week in Review is for. Good morning, I'm Bill Radke. One item from this week that we're asking you about is this report from Allstate Insurance that Seattle drivers are among the worst in America. Do you believe it? Why are we the worst? Please give an example from your life. Tell your story right now on our Facebook page. You can reach us also at Twitter at KUOW, on the telephone 206-685-BLAM. Reviewing the week's news, I'm Bill Radke with Knute Berger, the Mossback at CrossCut.com and columnist at Seattle Magazine, Joni Balter, news analyst and host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger. Hi, everybody.
Good morning.
So the way we felt about Boeing leaving, do you think Federal Way is feeling that way right now? One of the states, one of the Northwest's biggest and oldest companies, Weyerhaeuser, a company you associate with the forest, is moving to the city and leaving its landmark headquarters in Federal Way for a new building in Seattle's Pioneer Square. Seattle Mayor Ed Murray says he didn't go to Weyerhaeuser, they came to him.
They were interested in moving to Seattle. They were interested in finding a location that was close to transit. And they were interested in finding a location where folks could actually live and work in the same neighborhood. And that's how they settled on this spot.
The other reason, according to Weyerhaeuser, is that that iconic 400-acre campus, the green terraced thing you see off of I-5 and Federal Way, it's too big for them and too costly. So first of all, Knute, you just wrote about it this morning on Crosscut. First of all, does that cover the reasons why Weyerhaeuser is moving from Federal Way to Pioneer Square?
Yeah, it's basically, you know, the company's been reorganizing and to some degree downsizing. Mm. And this fabulous campus and building that they have in Federal Way is just too much. They said it was too expensive to maintain. They have 430 acres.
Mm-hmm.
And, now they can have I thought maybe they were attracted to Occidental Park's timber.
Yeah. The timber there. Yeah.
Yeah.
They thought it was still rolling down Yesler.
Right.
Right.
Sliding
Skid Row.
Skid Row.
Yeah.
So this is great news for Seattle, but look, can we start with what Federal Way loses before we go to Seattle? Weyerhaeuser had $7 billion in sales last year. They own or control 7 million acres of forest lands, 13,000 employees around the world. But even locally in Federal Way, that's a big hole for a suburb to fill, right?
It is. And the bad news, of course, is that Weyerhaeuser, which has been a huge citizen, corporate citizen, not just in Federal Way, but in Tacoma. I mean, mm-hmm. This is where the company, that area is where the company's roots are.
Right.
And so there's a lot of philanthropy and whatnot that's gone on as well. What they lose is their Boeing. What they gain is the potential of that site. In other words, you have a huge piece of property. It's right on I-5. There's a fabulous building there that could be occupied or repurposed.
But how is that a gain? You mean if it's occupied by somebody with more?
Yeah, the property could be sold to somebody who would develop portions of mm-hmm. it, and they could get more business in there. They mm-hmm. could get more housing in there. There's a lot of things they could do with parts of that property. Federal Way touts the fact that it doesn't have a city B&O tax. They're in a major transportation corridor. So they're feeling upbeat, although, they're also feeling the sting.
Sure.
Indeed. So up here in Seattle, you have to look at this. So downtown Seattle has been stretching north due to the efforts of Paul Allen mm-hmm. and Amazon. So downtown now, if the way I think of it, includes South Lake Union. And Pioneer Square was kind of this sort of soft, not so great southern edge of the downtown. But when Weyerhaeuser comes in, and don't forget, the tree growing company has become the really smart real estate company.
Right.
And what they know where the city can grow. The city can grow right there. The city, the southern edge of the city, this will be like Paul Allen meets Weyerhaeuser down there and really fortifies that. And don't forget, if Bertha ever gets out of the way, then that'll be quite the neighborhood, because there are some businesses moving in anticipation of there being a cool waterfront there.
Yeah, there are a lot of tech businesses there. One strange thing is that the one part of its company that Weyerhaeuser's leaving in Federal Way is a tech center that employs 100 people.
Speaking of the old facility that they abandoned, I've always thought it looked very Secret Lair, that terrace, yes, green roof thing that kind of blends into the hillside. It looks like a CIA campus or a, you know, an NSA.
Don't give
station.
Them any ideas.
Well, they need all the help they can get. They got to fill this thing. So I think they should be looking in that sort of spy slash villain kind of.
There's a 10-acre lake there. There's a giant rhododendron garden.
There is. And they say the rhododendron garden and they have a fabulous bonsai garden there, too, won't be affected. And they're being run by nonprofits right now. They've sort of, you know, moved them off into other management. Historic preservationists are very concerned about that building. Yeah. You know, it's considered really a masterpiece of modern architecture. It was built in 1971 by a major architectural firm. And the grounds are really important, too. And I think people would like to see, and I know the mayor told me, you know, that he'd like to see somebody come in there and take over that facility. But that only is about, takes up, you know, only a portion of the property that's going to be available there.
Well, let's talk about, you mentioned South Sound. The company started in Tacoma, and that was a big deal when it moved to Federal Way. Now, I mean, is Seattle, with all its growth and success, is it draining businesses away from areas like the South Sound?
Well,
or is this just a one-off?
Well, this is pretty interesting because the City of Destiny, as it was called, Tacoma, was the home of Weyerhaeuser around 1900. Correct me if I get the dates wrong here. Mm-hmm. And then in 1971, it moved to Federal Way. And this sort of completes the circle coming to Seattle because, you know, the whole sort of history of where the railroad and the tree-growing company would put their big mark.
Yeah.
Well, it's intriguing because high-tech companies have been moving out of the suburbs into the city, South Lake Union, Fremont, Pioneer Square, other places. So that seems to be a trend. The interesting thing is not to just dismiss Federal Way as a suburb. In planning terms, it's considered a core city. Mm. It's considered a place where we're trying to funnel growth. Sound Transit, light rail will eventually get there. And so in some ways, people, it really is more like, you know, Bellevue, but Bellevue 20 or 30 years ago.
I liked what the mayor described as their motivation in that they want to be close to transit. They want to be able to have their employees walk to work. I mean, this ideal that Seattle has been working toward, a place that you can live in and move around quickly and get out of your car, which people have been fighting over tooth and nail for so long, is actually turns out to be very attractive to at least one major company in Washington State. And if companies start moving into Seattle for that reason, because they want their employees to be happy and able to move around, fantastic.
One more question. The Pioneer Square, as we said, has been a ragged area. It's been a high crime area. How much do you see it really changing as the businesses in it change and grow?
One kind of basic principle on that is the more people you have on the street, the more eyes on the street, the more people you have invested in the neighborhood, the better off the neighborhood is. So in that sense, I think it probably helps.
I would call it transformational because it will really change the neighborhood with, as Eli just said, all those people. They mentioned a bunch of retail that would be part of the development. It is going to change it. Besides, we've already sort of redeveloped the north parking lot. So there's just that much more change and churn going on. And so it will really change the neighborhood.
Yeah, you have
no
to
doubt.
Partly consider the site itself. It's right in the middle of Pioneer Square. It's right adjacent to Occidental Park, which has been problematic from a public safety standpoint for a long time. I think the theory is, you know, people don't, we've had a conscious policy of concentrating the poor and homeless and other people in Pioneer Square. People aren't trying to push them out. The idea is exactly what Joni talked about, getting more diversity in there. I think people see this as transformational in part, the smaller picture, in terms of improving a major section right in the middle. And what's there now? It's a parking lot.
One thing I don't know if Weyerhaeuser has considered is that Federal Way is a long way to ride a bus for a protest. Pioneer Square is not. And a company that's involved in cutting down forests, turning trees into things that are not trees, there will be a lot of people in Seattle who will be happy to take their message straight to the new Weyerhaeuser headquarters downtown.
Very interesting. Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, Knute Berger, I'm Bill Radke. We continue the KUOW Week in Review with another big story, Amazon buying a $1 billion company that I'd never heard of. I've been fascinated to learn about it all this week, and I think you will be too in a moment. Welcome back to KUOW's Week in Review. Story number two on our list. This week, Amazon paid $1 billion cash for a live streaming website called Twitch that lets you watch video gamers playing games live. And before you scoff, in case you're a scoffer, last year Twitch put on a gaming championship that drew 32 million viewers. That's more than the audience for the finales of Breaking Bad, 24, and The Sopranos combined. We wanted to learn a little more about what this means for Amazon and really what the appeal is of, as people have been asking all week, what's the appeal of watching people play video games? So we invited gamer Scott Kurtz to tell us about it. He's known around town as a cartoonist and author of the webcomic PvP. Scott, welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
What is the appeal of watching other people play video games?
Oh, there are a couple appeals. First of all, these are pretty intense championships. It's just like any other sport or watching, as we were saying earlier, poker. And there's a huge prize money involved a lot of times, millions of dollars for these teams. Secondly is that a lot of people can learn about how to play these games. They're watching the best of the best play. They're picking up tips and tricks. And thirdly, it's just entertaining. There are many celebrities popping up on these Twitch streams.
Well, you are in the world of Twitch. You're one of the celebrities, right?
Partially, yeah. We have our own stream every Friday night. We play a game called WildStar, which is a massively online multiplayer game.
So I tune in and I want to watch you, and I see what and I hear what.
You see and hear me and my friends playing a video game very poorly. We are not competitive.
So humble.
We are terrible, but we're cracking jokes.
Why would I watch that? Because you're cracking jokes?
Because we're funny. Uh-huh. We're entertaining.
Okay.
Yeah. And also we have kind of a built-in audience from my comic strip.
Okay. Other questions for Scott?
Can I go back to the poker comparison?
Sure.
Because when I was trying to imagine what on earth would I be looking at or seeing, does it remind you that much of watching poker?
Yeah. In fact, there's a brand new game from Blizzard Entertainment called Hearthstone that's a card game. And people are watching those streams to see how these players build their decks.
Well, then does it teach you to be better at what you're doing?
Absolutely.
By watching the
Absolutely.
Good guys at it?
Mm-hmm.
I find myself feeling like a scoffer here, like
okay,
I was saying.
Thank you for being honest about that.
I'm feeling very scoffy about this. So what you must hear this all the time, and what is your reaction to the scoffers, the people who are like, so this is about sitting there on your couch watching someone else sitting on their couch playing a game that doesn't involve anything human happening?
I have been a scoffer myself. It's very scoffable. Look, most of TV is sitting around watching other people do things, cooking channels. I mean, what on TV is not watching someone else do something? The NFL is 11 minutes of action for, what, 2 hours of broadcast, I think Forbes once said.
Mm-hmm.
Don't quote me on that. But, yeah, I mean, you're sitting around watching other people do things. That's called television.
Yeah.
Is there something lost? You know, when you're sitting around watching other people do things on television, there are actually people doing things on television, cooking, playing football. They're humans exerting themselves to the best of their potential.
How is video gaming not a thing?
Yeah. Well,
very
it's
competitive
not a human
and
doing a thing, and so it
is,
maybe
it
you
is,
lose
though.
The
it's a human doing a thing.
It's humans doing a video thing.
Right.
There,
so
there you go.
I've also streamed myself.
Or something like that.
Rachel Ray doesn't hunt either, but she does something.
Here's my concern. There's an aspiration. This is my scoffy, curmudgeonly concern this morning, and maybe I just haven't had enough caffeine.
Bring it.
But there is an aspiration. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, maybe I'll have a new opinion in now that Jimmy's handed me coffee. There's an aspiration connected to a lot of what you see on television. You watch football, and yeah, it's, you know, not very much action, but kids go out and play Little League. Or you watch cooking shows, and yeah, it's a lot of it's fake and contrived, but you aspire to be a better cook in your own life. This is what I don't get. You watch someone else play a video game, and what do you aspire to?
Well, this is where me being an older gamer in my 40s is probably the wrong guy to bring on, because I'm a little get out of my yard about it myself. I think that a lot of kids today are aspiring to be Kardashians and online celebrities and sitting around playing video games all day. Maybe I can make a living at that. And yeah, maybe if they watch sports, they'd want to get outside more. I know that when my wife watches cooking shows, I'm usually eating what was on TV later that week.
Later, yeah.
But you know, I think it's a misnomer that every gamer is a big fat guy like me that just sits around and doesn't get a lot of exercise. But there are a lot of people who still do sports every week and want to watch these games. There's a lot of people who aren't gamers that watch these games.
Well, no, I, you know, my son as a teenager was a gamer. I mean, multi-user games, Dungeons and Dragons. I mean, all kinds. They used to have, you know, what, you know, member LAN parties where people brought their computers and hooked them up and played. So, you know, they and he turned that into a career. I mean, he works for a major gaming company, has worked for a couple of them. He plays the games. He, you know, one of the things, if nothing else, if you can't analyze the motivation, money. These is a huge industry. I had no idea until he was telling me he used to work for Blizzard, which makes World of Warcraft. And I had no idea that this was a 24-hour a day, every country in the world, millions of people online in this virtual space, playing games and kind of almost living out these really interesting lives, and the complexity of it and the richness of it and the compellingness of it is it just in and of itself is really an amazing thing.
Well, maybe we should go to what's in it for Amazon. So what are they?
Well, wait a minute. Before we go there, so I want to pick – you asked – you talked about this being a huge industry. I want to know, is Seattle seems very big in the gaming industry.
Huge, yeah.
Does that have to do with the nature of shooting and Minecrafting and, like, playing video games? Or is it just because, well, it's a tech industry, so duh, we're big? Or,
yeah, I think it's just a tech-savvy city.
Because I think of us as a city of doers more than watchers, to get back to your point. You know, is there some connection
Absolutely.
Between Seattle and gaming that I'm not getting?
You know, I don't know. I moved here 4 years ago. I moved from Dallas, where it is a very much sit in your house and avoid the heat kind of place. Mm. There's a lot more going on here. Once we moved to Seattle, we discovered that more people are out doing things than they were where we lived in Dallas.
Right.
But it's also a very tech-savvy town. Microsoft is here. Valve, Bungie, all these video game companies are here. So,
okay,
and so back to the Amazon. How does Amazon benefit from acquiring?
Well, they diversify into games. But honestly, I personally believe it's helping them compete with Google in advertising. Twitch gets 55 million unique users a month, 7 million log on every day, and their average time on site is 2 hours. By comparison, my webcomic has 11 million pages a month, and average time on site is 3 minutes. That's 2 hours of watching quote-unquote television that they could just run ads on.
Do you hear that, Eli? 2 hours of sitting around.
Yeah. Every parent of teenage boy is shivering to hear that. Yeah.
And also I read that Amazon is the largest or second largest seller of video games in the country or in the world. I don't know. But so there's probably what they call some sort of synergy with that. I thought it was interesting. I read on Vox that a main thing that the acquisition could do is help Twitch deal with the rising tide of copyright claims on its growing service as more and more gamers stream, record, and archive footage with copyrighted music in the background.
So, they do.
So people are sitting there playing, I don't know, Flashdance behind.
Exactly. Behind. As kids are wont to do.
Yeah, right. I'm trying to continue with the curmudgeonly.
Sure, absolutely.
So, and then they run afoul of the holder of the copyright for that song, and then Twitch gets sued, and they're like, oh, we don't have enough lawyers for all of this. Let's let someone with a lot of lawyers buy us.
Well, I'm sure Amazon will be in the same problem that any other company would be. I mean, honestly, when we stream, I don't play my Perry Como music because I know that's copyrighted material, and what they'll do instead is they'll just go in and retroactively remove the audio from your stream.
Oh.
And they have computers that do it without a human even touching it.
Do you worry that you're sort of you mention a minor celebrity because you're people like you, you're funny and you talk about what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you now, as this gets more and more exposure, do you worry that professional entertainers are going to move into your turf? Like if I'm not watching you because you're the very best gamer, which some people are,
right.
If I'm watching for you, then don't people want to watch Seth Rogen play video games and, you know, Justin Timberlake and on and on? Is that going to take over well, like they've taken over so much?
No,
celebrity culture.
I think it would be great. I think, you know, rising tide lifts all ships. So if Seth Rogen wants to play, you know, Minecraft and crack jokes with James Franco on Twitch,
right?
It's going to bring more attention to Twitch, and someone might watch my stream, and then I could earn revenue off of my stream.
Got it. Paul Rudd and Scott Kurtz both on Twitch. Scott,
hope.
Just great having you here and helping
so
us
much.
Understand what this billion-dollar acquisition is. Thank you.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, what a crazy thing to do, watch other people play.
Or listen to other people talk.
Or listen to other people talk.
There you
get off.
Go.
Get out of here, Canute. Get out. Yes, bum-sitting season is just beginning. The Cougars were on TV last night. Huskies play this weekend. The Mariners are in the playoffs. Seahawks are just about to start their season. By the way, has the Seahawks' success ruined them and us? We're going to talk about that later on KUOW's Week in Review. I got so caught up, I forgot to ask him about, do you know about this PAX gaming show that's going on right now? It's the Convention Center and the Paramount and
I do.
Benaroya.
I do. I've heard nothing about it, nothing but about it
yes.
for
okay.
days now.
And
okay.
This is the one where people dress up like they're
well, favorite. It's like they dress up almost every weekend
yeah,
like, on these.
Except it's the gamer.
Every time I go downtown, there's
it's
a whole
the gamer thing.
Group of folks dressed up.
Well, he's going to be doing a Dungeons & Dragons on stage in front of an audience in Seattle at PAX. That was
right.
Scott Kurtz joining us on KUOW's Week in Review. Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, Canute Berger, and me and you running down the big stories of the week. And this week, a federal judge ruled the city of Yakima is violating the Federal Voting Rights Act by diluting the Latino vote. Latinos make up more than 40% of Yakima's population, one-third of the voting age population, yet not one Latino has ever been elected to the Yakima City Council. And why not? Two words, at large. Yakima does not vote for council members by district in the general election. They vote at large, meaning each member is elected citywide. University of Washington political scientist Matt Barreto describes the problem with at-large voting.
I think that at-large electoral system has been identified historically in lawsuits as well as in academic research to really hurt minority populations. I mean, look, if you're less than 50% of the population, but you need to win 51% to get elected, it makes it very, very hard.
So this federal judge, Thomas Rice, ruled that in Yakima, quote, the non-Latino majority routinely suffocates the voting preferences of the Latino minority. Who wants to start with how you feel about this ruling?
Well, I'll start, and I'll say that, you know, I'm not a big fan of district elections in general, but the remedy here seems to fit the situation. You may notice that yesterday the governor wrote a letter to the Yakima City Council saying, I suggest, and he spent some time in Yakima, I suggest that you don't appeal this ruling because you're going to need district elections to remedy the situation that you have. And maybe one of the most compelling examples of that, you know, this trial was going to get into the history in Yakima, and it was going to go on for 4 weeks. And my understanding is that the campaign manager for Supreme Court Justice Steve Gonzalez was on the witness list. And so this was going to get into it here. There was an example in Yakima that was pretty interesting where a school board candidate, Graciela Villanueva, was running against someone named Jenny Rice. Mm-hmm. And Jenny Rice had dropped out. But when the election dropped out of the race, but when the election day came, she won because presumably, folks didn't like the Hispanic-sounding name. That also happened, and some folks here may add to that, with the election of Steve Gonzalez for Supreme Court.
I was just going to say that.
He did really poorly in the eastern Washington counties.
Right. You don't have to just focus on Yakima to see the dynamic of racially polarized voting. The same person that Joni is referring to here, David Perez, who helped with Justice Steve Gonzalez's campaign. And just for some context, Steve Gonzalez is the first Hispanic American justice on the state Supreme Court elected recently. He was running with no opponent until at the last minute, a guy named Bruce Danielson, who no one had really heard of, didn't have a very good reputation in legal circles, threw his name into the hat. So you've got a man with the last name Danielson versus a man with the last name Gonzalez. Gonzalez has been, you know, a Superior Court judge, prosecuted Ahmed Rassam, federal prosecutor, great resume. And all throughout Eastern Washington, Danielson beats Gonzalez. We only have Gonzalez on the state Supreme Court because he won in King, Pierce, and Snohomish counties and a couple others. So that's a statewide dynamic of racially polarized voting. And when you have that, you need to do something to counteract it. I will say, however, you want to find another city that has at-large council elections, Seattle.
Yes.
We are only recently moving to district elections. And the key difference, I think people would say, is that the racially polarized voting here, to the extent that it exists, is not anything near the racially polarized voting in Yakima, so that you can have at-large elections or some at-large elections for council, as we're going to have now, and not run into the degree of the problem that exists on the other side of the mountains.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding was that the one difference between the systems, because they have a hybrid system also in Yakima, is that the at-large voters vote in the district elections. In other words, that the district representatives are in the general election where the actual selection process is made.
It's kind of like our school board, where they run in the primary by district,
correct,
citywide.
Right,
And so that distinction is the issue, as far as the judge said. That she said, you know, I'm not saying you're doing this on purpose. I'm not saying you've done anything criminal, but I'm saying the effect of what you've set up here suffocates the Latino vote.
Yeah, I didn't understand that. As you describe it, it gives the white majority there a veto.
Yes, exactly. And so you've got a city with 40% Hispanic, 30% of the voters Hispanic, but then it gets undone there at the general election, and that's the part of it they want to untangle.
But the city of Yakima, and we can talk about how it could apply here, has said that creating a majority Latino district would marginalize Latinos in other parts of the city. Joni, you said at the top that you didn't like district elections.
Well, I don't like them for Seattle because we don't have the same problem as everyone here has said. We have a history of electing all kinds of folks to the city council, a very long history, actually. But there, it seems like they need a remedy. And, you know, that's just throwing up a flare about something that has to change, as far as I'm concerned, because...
Let's talk about here. What don't you like about district elections here?
What I don't like about it is I don't like so many council members sort of bragging about how they helped one corner of the city without helping the overall city. I think it sort of makes us into these little unique districts that that really sort of pits district against district. And this has always been the argument about this.
Right.
I want a city council members who sees the whole thing. And we would have a couple that way. Yes, I understand that. But I'd rather they all see the broad horizon.
All right. Well, sticking with what's representative, what does it take to be representative of your city? I'm thinking, for example, of salary. City council, $177,000. Average salary in Seattle, less than $40,000. Average age on the Seattle City Council was like 64 or something. Average age in Seattle, 36. So when we're talking about who's representing who, can you just look at someone's skin color or know their ethnicity or whatever it is and know whether they're representing your interests?
Well, you left off who they're getting contributions from, which is a very good indicator sometimes of who they're representing. And that's one of the arguments for districts in Seattle, that the cost of running a citywide race has required, and along with a number of other dynamics of running for council in the city, but it's encouraged people running for council to dip into the pockets of the same wealthy downtown power brokers, just to use a shorthand, and then they are accountable to them. And if you are running in just a district, you maybe can get around those gatekeepers and represent a different perspective.
Final thought before a break?
Well, I just think that Seattle has its own systemic problems, and one problem is that the city south of I-90 is a different city than much of the rest of the city in terms of education, infrastructure, and the kind of attention it's gotten. And I think that districts, to some degree, offer hope that people who live in those neighborhoods will represent those neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And the district system also will require, which Joni gave a good argument against, but the argument for, is that horse trading brings the marginal areas, it gives them leverage, it gives them power, and brings them into the conversation, so it's not just downtown donors.
That's a good point about the South End. I live in the South End, and there was a time on the Seattle City Council when something, and this isn't the exact number, but either 3, 4, or 5 of the council members lived in Madrona, if you recall.
By the way, I may have made a slight error. I may have said it was $177,000 a year for Seattle City Council. I think it's corrected to $117,000.
That sounds more accurate.
It feels better. Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, Knute Berger, KUOW's Week in Review, back in a moment. KUOW's Week in Review, running down the big stories of the week. And this week, annual memberships went on sale for Seattle's new bike share program, Pronto. What is bike share? Pronto spokesperson Kyle McMahon.
Bike share is basically kind of that first mile, last mile solution to public transportation. It's not necessarily a bike rental. It's more of kind of an alternative transportation, quick jaunts that you need to do around the city. You need to go from Capitol Hill downtown. Basically, what we're trying to do is make sure that everyone knows within Pronto Cycle Share, trips are supposed to be right around 30 minutes in length.
Two-wheel commuter Eli Sanders, you've got your bike, so you didn't sign up this week, right?
No, I rode my bike here, for example, so yes. I don't need the Pronto Bike Share as badly as others, but I can see myself using it. I could see myself at the Stranger needing to run off somewhere quickly, and maybe it's a day where I don't have my bike with me, and I go to the Bike Share stand, grab a bike, roll down the hill, and if I don't want to ride back up the hill, I get on the bus.
Is that how you ride? You just roll down?
Yeah. Whenever I can.
So this week you have the chance to pay $85 for an annual membership, and you get unlimited trips on these 7-gear bicycles that you find at 50 different stations around the city, and you use a smartphone app to find a station. You can unlock the bike with a key fob or a passcode. What if your destination isn't near the return spot? Do you know that what happens then?
I don't actually know, but my understanding is you're supposed to return them to the spot, but then I can imagine, I don't know this, I can imagine sort of a part of the service is to go round up the bikes because people, it's grab a bike, leave a bike, right?
Yeah.
I can imagine people going and...
And leaving them at the bottom of the hill?
And leaving them at the bottom of the hill.
The bikes might migrate from... from the tops of the hills to the bottoms. And in fact, we asked Pronto about that, and they said, yes, we're going to have vans to get the bikes where they want them. Vans. Because how else could you move a bicycle around the city? How could it get from here to there?
Vehicle.
Except in a fossil fuel burning motor vehicle. If this is such a great idea, why does bike share require government subsidies?
I'm sorry, I was stuck on the other alternative for getting them up the hill, gondolas.
Gondolas. Thank you. Alaska Airlines paid a couple million to have its logo on all the bikes, and Vulcan and Children's Hospital and REI are paying some money. But everywhere, there, you know, government funds are involved. Does that make it less than sustainable?
The government funds our roads.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, driving is not self-sustainable.
No, clearly not.
So it seems like actually a relatively minor investment from the government to encourage something that will have benefits for people's health and the amount that we pay for health care and maybe our traffic congestion. I don't see that as being a big, good argument or a big problem.
I like how Eli was scoffing at that argument just the way he scoffed at Twitch
scoffer
minutes
in chief
ago.
Is what we actually call him here.
It's a good scoff, though.
The government has an interest in mobility and getting more people around without necessarily cars. So you can see that connection pretty quickly.
Knute, anything more to say?
Not really. I think it's a very cool new thing, and it'll be interesting to see how it works. It seems like it fills a need. Many a time I can take a bus almost to a destination.
Right.
Can't, like that last mile or whatever. The wait is so long or whatever. So it seems to me like something that would be really practical and useful for people.
A big complaint drivers have is that cyclists don't follow the rules and don't think they should have to, which is obviously true. You're not going to scoff at that argument, right, Eli? Admit it.
It does happen sometimes, okay. But there's a lot of complexity to that argument.
Well, I was going to say, no drivers drive that way.
Thank you, which is my point, that maybe it's cyclists who should be complaining about the drivers. Allstate says Seattle drivers are just about the worst, and we're going to get to that in a moment on KUOW's Week in Review. stuff happened this week, but what does it all mean? Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, Knute Berger, I'm Bill Radke, doing KUOW's Week in Review. And this week, Allstate Insurance released something called the 2014 America's Best Drivers Report. Seattle wasn't in that part of it so much, more like the worst drivers. Seattle drivers ranked 173rd out of 200 U.S. cities for our ability to stay safe on the road. We are, just only one more number here coming, 36% more likely than the national average to get into an accident. Why do you suppose that is?
I have so many reasons. I don't know where to start here. I would start with there's so many people new to the city that they kind of don't know where they're going. And so you can see them kind of slowing through intersections. And then
but slowing should be a safe thing, shouldn't it?
Slowing, good. But then you got to figure out which way you're going to turn right, left, stay in the middle. There's all that. There's so much construction here. So that makes it kind of hard to maneuver around all these things. In this high-tech city, too many people are on the phone while they're driving.
Like, I'm getting a lot of head nods in the room.
I was following a texter to the studio today.
And one more reason, they might be stoned.
Oh, wow. There's that, too. we asked this question, by the way. We're going to get back to this. I want to hear what you think. But we asked on KUOW's Facebook page, KUOW Public Radio, and got a whole bunch of theories. Ann says the biggest problem with Seattle drivers is that they are not aware enough of their surroundings, are very self-absorbed. Now, I don't know if that goes with the texting, that they're, you know, gadget
absorbed. Self-absorbed, you stare straight ahead.
Right. And many, tip of the hat to our listeners, many of whom either posted or referenced the Portlandia sketch. Have you all heard the what happens at a four-way stop? Yeah. Okay. So cue up Portlandia. This is a much condensed version of a classic bit.
No. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
You go.
No. You first.
You go.
I'm gonna go after you.
Hit the road, Jack.
No, you go.
You go.
No, you go.
You go.
No, you go.
No, you go.
I'm not going until you go.
No, you go.
I'm not gonna go until you go.
No, you go.
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 Sure? Okay.
You sure?
What? Come on, you go.
You want to? No? You go.
You just.
There it is.
Sounds about right. There's also what Maria Semple said in Where'd You Go, Bernadette, about Seattle never finding a four-way stop that it couldn't turn into a five-way stop.
By the way, Portland was even worse than us. We were 173rd. Portlandia was 177th out of 200.
Well, and that stop sign thing, that goes on between cars and pedestrians.
Absolutely.
All the time, where pedestrians who have the right-of-way, even when you stop, won't go until you've gone and will wave you through and get quite angry. It turns from polite to rage very quick if you don't do what they say. I think one of the biggest problems with is that we no longer have a driving consensus culture.
Right.
Which is that we have a lot of people from other places where there are different rules. And when you go to other cities and you go to New York or you go to San Francisco or go to Los Angeles, you learn really quickly what the rules are and what's acceptable, you know, whether it's, you know, waiting before you go through to let all the left turners go because the traffic is so bottled up, or whether you drive in the left lane or not. I mean, there are all kinds of little local customs. We no longer have that consensus. And so you have people, old school Seattle drivers who are driving kind of as if they live on an island and everything is sort of, you know, hi, neighbor, and going really slow.
Ma and Pa Kettle.
Yeah, exactly. You've got that. And then you have these, you know, ultra aggressive people who don't believe in signaling and they're driving at high speed and texting.
The zipper merge.
This is the zipper merge problem.
Oh, no, it's back.
Bringing
it all
up
comes
again.
Back to the zipper merge.
It always comes back to the zipper merge, which, if you're just joining us on Zipper Merge Beat, that means that in New York, for example, everybody knows to use all the pavement that there is, so you just get as close as you can and you signal. Everybody does the same thing. Nobody, it's not rude. It's just the thing. Whereas here, you've got some people doing that and everybody else hating them for doing that, one example.
And you see it in all kinds of even tiny ways, like how much distance people leave between their bumpers when they're at a stoplight. Some people leave like a full car length or half a car length between, you know.
Right.
It's like, well, if space is efficiency, can't we agree that it's like a 2-foot rule or...
Because they're not looking behind them at how efficient they're being. How the cars are stacked up. They're just being extra safe.
And that goes to the person who said the cluelessness. So we need a driver's summit.
Driver's summit. Or and I want to know if Bill is a big zipper person. It seems
like I am now, baby.
You are doing that.
And the beauty of it is that because other people aren't yet caught on, and they will be.
Oh, they will.
Because I'm a rare zipper merger, I've got all this lane in front of me that's empty, and I'm taking all of it because the Department of Transportation told, in case you missed this, a few weeks ago, told me on the air that that's how you're supposed to do it. So I don't feel guilty at all.
I want to hear that interview. That interview is jive.
I don't see the fingers. I don't feel the hate. It was nothing but good. Safest drivers in the Northwest, Boise. Boise was third safest in America. Is that because they don't have so much inflow that they more know the rules? I was surprised. Because Boise's got snow. We don't even have snow here.
I think it comes back to something Knut was saying. They don't have a lot of things on the road. As I understand it, they have cars, right?
And not that many.
Yeah, and here we've got cars and bikes jostling.
Oh, blame the bicycles, of course.
It's an argument for dedicated bike lanes and cycle tracks.
Oh.
And we have trolleys coming, and trolleys that already exist, and buses, and bike share bikes, and. And I think there's just a lot more for people to deal with in a culture that hasn't come to a consensus about the rules.
Like all of Dr. Seuss going by on the roads, right? All those characters.
That's a great visual. Well, doing their wongoozes and their zinziggles.
I did an article last year about the introduction of the car into Seattle and the chaos that created and the negotiation of new rules between cars, bikes, wagons, trolleys, streetcars, yeah. Cable cars, stagecoaches. I mean, it was like amazing. And there are all these ordinances and legal cases and everything that came up as a result of people sort of jostling. I think we're going through a 21st century version of that.
Yeah. And we just need to pick one mode, just everybody on bicycle, and make it simple.
Well, there you go.
We can review. Maybe people are checking the Mariners score while they're driving. We're going to get into a sports season cranking up and why the Seahawks are now ruined after a break on KUW's Week in Review. The only thing that could make this hour of KUOW's Week in Review better with Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, and Knut Berger here is if Luke Burbank could also be with us.
So sad that I wasn't able to make it. But that's an amazing thought. Can I just thank you guys right here at the top of this segment for giving me a real gift this week? Because I don't think I'm ever going to live to be 100, but I know what it feels like to be 100, and it's called listening to you guys discuss video games.
I know.
That is so charming. Thank you.
Football season is cranking up, Luke. Are you excited?
I am very excited, although I know that the plan is to talk about the somewhat pernicious effect this success may have on the Seattle football fans, and I have witnessed it. I even witnessed it beginning last year before we'd even won the Super Bowl, and it makes me nervous.
How so? What'd you witness?
Well, I was at the so-called Fail Mary game where the Seahawks beat Green Bay play that should not have gone our way. It was
Golden Tate. It was legit.
It was legit.
Was given a catch that was, let's just say, questionable.
No.
And I was walking up after the game. I was walking up First Avenue, and I saw these Green Bay Packer fans walking by, and they were so devastated, not because they had lost, but because they told me about how mercilessly they were taunted by the Seahawks fans, and they were just sort of devastated, and I actually felt really bad for them, because it's one thing to win the game, but it's another thing to, I think the problem is that Seattle fans in general have been in our own minds an oppressed minority group.
Yep.
And now all of a sudden we've seized the levers of power, and we've got a lot of scores to settle, and it ain't pretty.
Okay, and we're going to get to other sports that are in swing, too. But since we're on Seahawks, I have one other reason why the Seahawks have been ruined, Luke. It's not just that the fans have gotten jerky, but isn't it way less fun now that we're not the underdog? You wanted, even if you didn't love boxing, you wanted Rocky to overcome the long odds. And after he was the champ, they had to work hard to find plots where he was still facing adversity, because that's what makes a story interesting. And that's gone, right?
Yeah, it's no fun being Ivan Drago.
No. The Karate the Kid was picked
he told
on.
Rocky, I must break
yes,
you.
Yes, I must. I will break
not,
you.
Not aware of Rocky V.
Seabiscuit, you can't win. You're too small. Jamaican bobsled. Wait a minute. Jamaican totally bobsled off. Teams could never succeed.
You guys are completely off. A true Seahawks fan.
Slumdogs can't be millionaires.
A true Seahawks fan will find a way to feel like an underdog no matter what.
Really?
Yes.
How do you do that?
That's what sports radio is all about.
You mean
know?
You have to feel
aggrieved? the national people aren't picking us to repeat the Super Bowl. Ugh. It's an anti-Seattle prejudice.
That's so right, Skip. Yeah, I've been listening to a ton of sports radio, and that's the obsession du jour, is that we're being disrespected by Peter King from Sports Illustrated.
Exactly. Precisely. And so this idea that we're just swaggering around and all that. No. People watched that preseason game last night. And if nothing else, it sends fear into our hearts, that hubris is going to bring us down.
Yeah, well, hubris is an ugly thing to watch. And you have to look at some of the stats here. And this is wet blankety, and I apologize. But
you and Eli, go ahead and scoff.
Just want to steal my scoff
crown. I'm stealing your scoff crown.
See, they don't respect Eli's scoff Domus, his championship. He's the defending scoffer.
He is the defending.
I'm just happy I passed scoffing off to a new generation.
A few facts here, folks. There's only been, 8 repeats, as they call it, since the Super Bowl began. It's tough to do because everything has to go exactly the way you want. Nobody can break a leg. Everything just has to go your way. So it's going to be tough. And in that way, we are the underdog because we know it's tough to repeat. And I say that as someone who actually was born and raised in Pittsburgh, where they went after one for the thumb. That would be 5 Super Bowls.
Oh, I was at that game. Don't remind me. Uh-huh. Hey, by the way, I don't want to be a statistical wet blanket, Joni, on your theory. But the thing about probability is that what has happened in the past has no effect on the future. And one of the teams that's being picked more than the Seahawks is the Denver Broncos. Now, here's something that's happened even less than Super Bowl champs repeating. A team that lost in the Super Bowl coming back to win the Super Bowl the next year has only happened twice in the modern era of football. And yet people are picking the Denver Broncos. So there's lies, damn lies, and then NFL statistics.
And hopes for an underdog comeback.
Listen to you guys.
Those people need to watch live gaming is what they need to watch.
Yeah.
So much more exciting. Meanwhile, the Cougars lost last night at CenturyLink Field. The Huskies start play at Hawaii tomorrow. The Seattle Reign are the best team in the National Women's Soccer League. They play in the championship Sunday afternoon in Tukwila. Sold out. It's standing room only there. Seahawks season starts next week. The Mariners are in the hunt. And right there on the bubble of making the playoffs.
And it's almost September. Can you imagine? I think the Seahawks actually shamed the Mariners into this with all this just unbelievable adoration and excitement about the Seahawks. And everyone's going okay, the Mariners are about to start. And then they started, and they're doing amazing going into September.
All is not well in Marinerville. Do you guys know about the Jesus Montero story?
No, what happened? Yes.
Okay, so we, a couple of years ago, traded for this really hot prospect from the Yankees, Jesus Montero. He came to camp. He didn't really perform. He played a season for us. His big problem has been that he's gained a lot of weight. This year he reported to spring training 40 pounds overweight. So he's been in the minors. He's trying to rehab. And one of the Mariners' scouts, so basically somebody that works for the same team as this guy, was apparently ridiculing him from the stands at this minor league game this week and then sent him an ice cream sandwich to make fun of him. He came out of the dugout and threw the ice cream sandwich at the Mariner scout, which is an ironic twist for a guy whose problem is weighing too much. I mean, maybe that's part of his plan. Throw the bad food at other people as opposed to eating it. But anyway, that was an incident that unfolded. Jack Zarensic, the Mariners GM, was reached. He said he's aware of the situation. And
Well, didn't he go after the guy with a baseball bat, too?
Well, he was holding a baseball bat in the other hand and throwing an ice cream sandwich.
Maybe
so the guy's
reversed.
A two-tool player. You can't say that he's a multitask.
All right. Well, if you'd rather not deal with sports at all ever, my condolences. But if you're enjoying the whole thing, dig the whole ride on KUW's Week in Review. Any last thoughts, Luke Burbank?
Listen, Tom Landry said it, when the coach of the Dallas Cowboys, when you get to the end zone, act like you've been there before.
Right.
So if we get back to the Super Bowl and we win, let's. You can be classy and loud. I've dedicated an entire lifetime to studying this principle.
Luke Burbank, who's on Live Wire tonight. What time is that? 8 o'clock, Luke?
8 o'clock. That's
8
right.
O'clock. His podcast is TBTL, Too Beautiful to Live. Thanks for coming on, Luke.
Thank you so much.
We've got Eli Sanders from The Stranger, and we've got Knute Berger from Crosscut.com. He's the Mossback. Joni Balter is a news analyst and host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. We asked you on KUOW's Facebook page why Seattle drivers would be so unsafe. Natalie says, 2 weeks ago while driving on I-5 during morning rush hour, the driver next to me was taking a hit off a homemade bong. Joni, there you go. Vindicated. Let's see. Sarah says, I've been honked at by drivers going the wrong way around a roundabout because I'm apparently in their way. Love it. KUOW's Week in Review. Thanks for joining us.